Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. This week, my guest is best-selling author Adam Benferrato, author of the compelling new book, A Minor Revolution, How Prioritizing Kids Benefits Us All. The Atlantic said of A Minor Revolution that it's an extremely sympathetic and worthy attempt to protect kids. This is a book that reads like a manifesto. His ideas are bold, to the point, and ambitious. Salon praised Adam's work as ambitious. His unifying argument is anti-inertial. The book blew my mind. And friend of the podcast, Heather McGee, author of The Sum of Us, said Adam weaves compelling real-life stories with legal and economic analysis to deliver a bracing indictment of our society's self-sabotage. He doesn't end there, however. His final recommendations for how to change course are both revolutionary and accessible. Adam is a professor of law at Drexel University. A graduate of Yale College and Harvard Law School, he served as a federal appellate clerk and an attorney at Jenner & Block. He is the author of the award-winning New York Times bestseller, Unfair, and is also the author of numerous scholarly articles and popular essays. Let's dive in. Hey, Adam. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
So, truth in advertising, unlike your book jacket photo, you have some facial hair. It looks nice.
Yes, this is the pandemic dad beard, which everyone thought it was an improvement, so I just left it.
I think it's good. It's like the, what do people say? It's like natural contouring for men. Definitely.
Exactly, and it's a nice sort of transition into midlife, because it kind of buys you a little bit of extra time every day. Like if you have to shave every day, this I can get by like, you know, 3 or 4 or even a week without much personal grooming.
Yeah, this is how I do my podcast. I hope you don't feel objectified in some way. What's that cool artwork behind you on the mantle?
So that's actually a painting by my uncle. So my mom was an artist, and I have a lot of art in my house, and it's kind of a side passion of mine. So I like to, whenever in my office at work too, some people come in and are like, oh my gosh, this tiny office is like an art gallery. And it's kind of how I create my good research and writing space.
I really think that's important. It's funny how I think there may have been or still remains a perception that the only kind of space in which a person could work is with as few visual distractions as possible. But for me, it turns out if I'm writing creatively, I need to have this kind of warm, hospitable, cozy, artistic environment, not something antiseptic and I don't know, office-like.
Yeah, no, I feel really similarly. I think for me, we all kind of have our approaches. I have a colleague who, her approach is like lots of papers stacked everywhere. And I think No, she loves it though. I think that's everything is within arm's reach, printed out. And for me, it's the opposite. I like kind of pristine, or everything kind of ordered externally, particularly on a big book project where you just have a million ideas and a lot of, you know, the process for me is just not panicking when I'm being pulled in all of these different directions. And I'm one of these people who, you know, I think I always write a book that's like twice as long as it ought to be to actually have an audience of readers. I really should probably specialize in writing like World War II books, because that's really where the 1,000-page book makes sense. But I think for me, one of the ways I manage that sense of just feeling overwhelmed and pulled in a million directions is having this kind of almost like museum space where everything's like particularly clean. I think particularly having two little children too, it's nice to have an area of the house which is kind of untouched as a means of a little escape. I don't have a man cave, but I kind of have a nice clean office.
I'm glad, I have to say, that what you're talking about, because I have a now what used to be my husband's and my bedroom is now my office. But when I was writing Big Dirty Money, we were doing this renovation on the back of the house, which it doesn't matter, but it created a different bedroom space, right? And so this has changed my life because the way I used to work on things is I'd have to kind of go downstairs into a living room. And we have a really small, like 100-year-old house. So there's lots of little nooks and crannies and tiny rooms, but the living room isn't very big. And I would just like have all of my books in a row on the back of the couch up against the wall. So I knew where everything was. But then if someone was coming over, I had to move everything back. And in the process of moving things back and forth, your ideas get lost. They fly out somewhere. I don't know. And so now just having, you know, I might not have stacks of paper, but I do have stacks of books and bookcases with all the books from the library. And then all, like, I don't know if you have this habit, but if I read a secondary source, and my book now is about the history of tax in America and which is, you know, goes back to even before the beginning of America.
It's a big project.
It's a big project because that's how I often do things. And of course, it has to get smaller for the book. But I could be reading something super interesting where there's a quote from Abraham Lincoln. But then I'm like, oh, I need to find the primary source. And then I actually get the primary source. And then I have to read that. So like everything, like I now have a 2-volume set of a biography of Taft. Like I've gone down a Taft like rabbit hole, and probably, you know, I'll have one sentence. I mean, it'll be more than a sentence on him, but like, it's amazing how much I learn about the world and then it doesn't end up in my book. So maybe my books don't end up too long, but there's a lot of information that ends up on the cutting room floor. Like I know better than putting it all in and giving it to my editor because then she'll kill me. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a little bit of a challenge of academics who are used to being exhaustive and keeping careful track of sources, coming into a world in which a lot of the pressures are the opposite, right? Like just kind of tell us one story, tell us one research study, get in and out. And I think, you know, the world we live in today, even, you know, in the time from when I was doing research papers in college to the present, the access to information is absolutely stunning. I mean, it's right. Wonderful for someone who's trying to delve into that history. But now, you know, it used to be you have to go up to Yale and go to the Beinecke Rare Book. And now it's just like a click and you have access to every right. word that was written in any language for all time.
Yeah, but this is our skill set, right? Like, I actually like flipping the world upside down and not, and sort of being able to think like an academic, but present like a journalist in that, you know, you're right. Like, I remember card catalogs. You remember those in
yeah,
Sterling
right.
Library? I mean,
totally.
And now the other day I was looking at something and you can find, you know, a front page story from the New York Times from whatever era you want for your primary source. So like, I mean, what I, you know, I see that you do this in your work. Let me just switch I'm going to talk about both of your books, but in talking about A Minor Revolution, your book that just came out, that is fabulous, by the way, you do what is necessary to, I think, both engage a general audience who, you know, who care about children or have children of their own or, you know, what, you know, that's kind of like, you know, you engage a general audience who wants to know more about the topic by telling people stories, but not stories that you read about. You actually interview people. And what I notice and I appreciate is that you have a theory about the kinds of rights that children deserve, and you break that into 6, you know, sort of developmental stages with accompanying rights that should go with each of those 6 stages. But instead of just listing, ticking things off and making theoretical arguments and citing both the literature and the case law and so on, instead of doing that, you flip it around, and every segment of your book begins with at least one person. And so, you know, I think that's really important. There are people who will focus on the stories and kind of skim through the data. There'll be others, maybe, some academics who are heartless and don't want to hear about people will skip the people maybe and just look at the footnotes. I don't know. There's something for everyone. And I appreciate the accomplishment and you're putting this together. And I wonder how it was that you decided to structure your book that way and also how you found these people to interview.
Yeah. So I think I'm someone who has always been kind of an academic at heart in terms of an interest in facts and evidence and research. But I also have always loved stories. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, something that I was in college. I actually thought I might be a novelist or a fiction writer. That was a real passion for me. And I think, you know, when I decided as an academic to write for a broader audience, you know, I knew that part of that had to be bringing in real voices, children's voices, and the voices of adults looking back on their childhoods. And I knew that I was wanted to take sort of a journalistic approach with this, as opposed to, you know, when I do certain empirical research with psychologists, you know, we recruit participants and do things like this. I wanted to take an approach where I kind of found stories through all of these different means. And it was actually incredible. You know, like Ghani, this man that I talked to, who was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole when he was 15 years old.
That's a heartbreaking story.
Heartbreaking. And he is just this, at age 46, when I talked to him, this amazingly insightful individual. And I connected with him because of a student who I was having a conversation about the project I was doing on. And she said, oh, I met this incredible guy. Actually, he was imprisoned when I was an undergraduate. And I actually have his contact information. Do you want me to put you in touch? Wiley, this boy that I interview, who at 17 engages in this protest of gun violence at his school in Arkansas. How did I find him? I was on Twitter one day and I came across a tweet that his mom had written about his experience with, you know, the dean of students there. And I just sent her a note and said, hey, do you think Wiley might actually like, this is what I'm working on. Do you think he might want to chat with me? The hilarious thing about that story is here I am writing this book about children's rights and this particular chapter about empowering young people. And the lawyers at Penguin Random House are like, before you talk to Wiley, I need you to get permission from his mother. Here's the particular forms you have to. So there were still many, many hoops, even though this was taking more of a journalistic approach that I had to jump through. But what made this project really so personally meaningful to me was these individual conversations. Many of them were really challenging, pushing me beyond, I think, skills. I think I'm a good researcher. I think I'm a good writer. But talking to someone about the day that their parents were arrested and taken away.
That was a brother and sister that
Adam and Ariel, when they were 3 and 6, I talked to both of them. You're revisiting the most painful and in some ways impactful moments of their entire life and manage it. And again, trying to actually learn. So asking questions, not simply sitting back, but asking questions and sometimes asking hard questions, but also being a human, and I think I'm someone who feels immensely for children, and so it's particularly hard. I mean, I would tear up myself during interviews, which is, I think some journalists would say, well, you can't do that. But for me, I think that was part of the process, and I think I'm just so grateful for people. And I think the people who talked to me about some of these painful moments, so many of them said, I'm doing this not because it's not so, so hard, but because I don't want this to happen to other children. That's like the most important reason.
So I'm early on in describing this process, you mentioned that when you were in college, you thought you might be a fiction writer, or maybe you said journalist too. I'm curious, two things. What residential college were you in, and what kind of what was your major, and what kind of involvement did you have in writing in college?
Yeah, so I was in Davenport, and I actually just gave a talk back at Yale a week and a half ago. And hilariously, they took me out to dinner at the Union League. And everyone was like, how many times did you go to the Union League?
I was what is the Union League?
Oh, it's you know, according to the people who took me out, you know, it's like the place to go. It's where all Yale students go. And I said, I didn't have any money actually in college. Although the hilarious thing is I could see from our table, I could see my freshman year dorm room where I lived in the basement. But my major was history.
Wait, can we stop for a second?
Yes.
What is wrong with these people? When I went out to dinner in college, I went to Wawa and got a chili dog and a pack of Camel Lights. What the hell? Who has money?
I don't know. I think maybe it's you know, they're academics. I don't think they went to Yale. They just have the perception that that's where all Yaleys go.
Well,
I knew about the Union League, and certainly we can talk about the impact of wealth on college education down the road.
But major, you said.
Yes, history major. And I think that, again, you can see in both of my books, you know, I start out this one with a newspaper from 1906. And I think history is a huge part of how I approach my work. Now, the writing aspect of things, I've always loved fiction. And I think I started out doing fiction writing classes right from the first year. I took a fiction little workshop with 16 students. And by my senior, I had gotten very serious. So every day, every week, I would write. It was a one-on-one tutorial with this amazing guy, Wes Davis, professor. And I would meet with him at this Greasy Spoon at 8 a.m. And I'd have written a short story for him every week. And it was the most amazing experience. It was a moment when I thought, wow, I could really do this, because Wes would actually treat the story I wrote as if it was in the New Yorker. He would treat it with the respect and the critical. He wasn't always like, this is great, but always as if this was something serious and worthy. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm a writer today, is because of those people who kind of treated me as of even in college, and it's a topic, you know, we can talk about more, but as like a full capable human being, even though I wasn't yet there, it really was this sense of that I could be something in the world, and that I could realize my dreams. And I think I got that. I was very lucky. I got that from my parents, and I got that from teachers at every stage. But I think that's why I end up in a position now where I actually am a writer, because I got that encouragement. Not that I was better than other people, but that I was lucky enough to have people tell me that story, that I could do this.
And was this like a directed reading class, so you got credit, or was this voluntary?
I got credit. So I had gone away my junior year to Oxford, and I had done, they're all tutorials over there. And one of the tutorials I took was a writing oriented one where I did the same thing. And so when I came back to Yale, I said, I want to see if I can do this. And I searched around for a professor who was actually willing to do this. It was incredible. It was like, I feel very lucky, but it certainly shaped the trajectory of the rest of my life.
And I promise to get to the book. A lot of, people interested in Booked Up are writers themselves, are curious about the writing process. And you have now led me to another question. I'm going to further interrogate you, but I see you with this Greasy Spoon. Which one, by the way?
So I'm forgetting the name. It was right.
What street?
What is that called? Is that, I'm forgetting. Is it, it's the one right that Atticus used to be,
York Street or
York
Church Street,
Street
or
yeah,
Chapel?
I'm starting to
corner
forget.
Of Chapel and York, maybe. I don't
like
know.
Like the art galleries on and the British Museum, that street.
Yes.
Whatever that
I
one
remember.
Is called.
Yeah. Okay, I don't know, but I think it's like Chapel Street or what.
So we used to go, you know, 8 a.m. I think I'd usually get the pancakes.
Oh, yum.
It was delicious. I think that set me off on this path. Now, Wes, what he wanted me to do was to go and teach English.
This is what I'm going to ask you. What happened next? Like, why did you end up in law school?
He said, you know, I think what you should do is be a writer. And one way to do this is you write your first book about an experience you have. So to pay the bills, I found you this job. It's on like a Navy cruise ship for a year, and you're going to teach English to a bunch of like 18-year-old soldiers. And I was like, that's interesting. I can see a version of myself that does this, but maybe not. And what I did instead, I got into law school.
Wait. Yeah. I need to pause because what? Like, you have this advisor who found you a job on a Navy cruise ship teaching English and said this will be good for you. And you said, and this is a mentor who has committed every week to you, and you had...
Well, he was
very... independence to say no. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it wasn't floated as you must do this.
Okay.
I think it was like, hey, here's a crazy idea that might be really cool. I thought, yeah, that could be really cool. I also, you know, all of our lives, even at 22, are complicated. And, you know,
yes.
I had gotten a girlfriend when I was in Oxford who was English and living in England. And I had another part of me that wanted to change the world and thought, well, I want to fight injustice. I want to go to law school.
Right.
And so what did I do? I hedged my bets. I deferred. Harvard let me defer for a year. I went off. Do you too? Deferred?
Oh, my God. Yes.
It's the path. It's the path.
I wanted to write a novel my year off, but then I ended up going to law school. But yes.
Oh, my God. The parallels continue. So I went off and lived in England on the old coaching road between Oxford and London. My then girlfriend's family had bought this 16th century farmhouse. And so half of the time I spent kind of helping to renovate the 16th century farmhouse. And the other half of the time I spent writing a novel. I then headed off to law school, and during law school worked on the novel, got an agent, and thought,
wow,
what am I going to do now? The publishing world made that decision for me in part. We sent it out to these publishing houses, which were uniformly very positive about my writing, but said, this is too experimental. We can't kind of sell this outside of... Colt, why don't you just tell the story straight? Just rewrite these parts of it, because... these parts are perfect, and get rid of this other stuff. And at this time, by this moment, I was about to go clerk on the DC circuit. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to put this on the back burner. Life is long. I'll focus on being a lawyer and a law professor. And I think have managed to find a way to get back to it by writing nonfiction books, but always trying to have an ear for those stories and trying to bring that in. Now, you know, in the long term, I think fiction writing is always going to be an important part of my life. And I expect you may feel similarly that, you know, you have to have the long view, and you don't actually have to say no to things, a hard no. You can say maybe a little later. And that's kind of been my approach.
This is so fascinating to hear this about you. I feel like if we'd accidentally run into each other at an academic conference getting a cup of coffee, we would have done this. It's so nice.
I think so. Parallel lives.
Yeah. I want to talk about your writing. And briefly, before we talk about A Minor Revolution, I want to mention the book Unfair, which became a New York Times bestseller and won some kind of award, you say. So, that's important. But what's more important is what the book's about and how prescient you were. So do you want to tell me, since that's not the one I read for today, a little bit more about the book than I would have gotten from that book jacket or the interviews you've done on Unfair.
Yeah. So, you know, the two areas that I have really always been interested in are kind of children's issues, children's rights issues, and then criminal justice. And actually, there's a lot of overlap, as I think anyone who reads the newspaper is aware. And my first book really came out of kind of teaching the criminal law course and doing a lot of scholarship in the area of kind of how cognitive biases kind of undermine justice. And so, you know, this book is really focused at looking at a criminal law case from sort of soup to nuts and all of the ways in which biases can really distort outcomes. And that comes in our initial police interactions. It comes in problems with eyewitness identifications and false confessions. It comes into the biases that judges and prosecutors bring. It comes into the fact that our approach to corrections does not serve the ends, whether those are retributive or general deterrence related, that we purport that it does. And so this book, you know, I think the parts of it which have continued to resonate and be relevant are certainly parts related to racial biases, as well as concerns with, you know, Supreme Court justices not in fact being umpires. I think strangely, some of the areas that seemed very, very far out indeed. I remember having a conversation about this section of the book in which I talked about the potential for virtual trials to kind of alleviate some of these bias concerns. The idea that if, for example, the color of skin of the defendant has an impact on sentencing or on, you know, a prosecutor's decisions on pursuing bail or whatever the matter is, maybe we should actually blind the process. And maybe one way we can do that is through a more controlled trial where actually everything is kind of online. People wear virtual reality headsets. I put this in my editor. I still remember saying, I think we should cut this part. I think this is too far. I don't think that'll ever happen. And now where are we? We lived through a pandemic in which so much of what lawyers did actually very quickly moved virtually online. And in a world in which, you know, just over the last week, Apple's big new product is a virtual reality headset, which they see as this is the future of how people actually are going to have meetings and collaborate and do all of this stuff.
Yeah, and I think about, you know, as you noted, you know, here you say maybe this is in 2015, you know, that virtual trials could reduce some of the biases we see. And as you just said, with a pandemic, court was in some places still is. Hearings still are on Zoom, and I think about the special committee to investigate the attack on the Capitol on January 5th. A lot of, as well as the various impeachments, the two impeachments, the use of video to try to tell a story about what happened. You know, whether it was the New York Times using what the New York Times had done, putting together disparate pieces of the footage, so it would actually run simultaneously while you could see what the president himself was doing, is really very helpful. I think it's much more helpful for a modern day jury to be able to see the visuals than just to listen to the lawyer's opening and closing arguments. So it's fascinating what the possibilities are, but of course, this introduces some other problems because prosecutors, of course, are going to have much more funding to be able to accomplish that. And an ordinary defendant, the idea of now, in addition to having to hire a lawyer, but a videographer, cinematographer, what you name it, you know, and that's going to affect. I'm not trying to criticize you. It's just a fun topic to explore.
I think it is. And I think to me, one of the lessons, though, is a lot of law, and I think legal thinking is inevitably very conservative. We kind of assume that things must remain as they are, and any change will just be too disruptive and things will crumble. And in fact, I think any legal system particularly one in a world that is rapidly changing, has to change too, and has to keep up. And I think what the pandemic shows us is just how quickly things can radically change. And I think that's a lesson that I certainly took to the new book project, where in some ways the vision of the future that I offer up is seemingly even more radical, right? These some of the ideas, particularly at the end, are even more bold or ambitious. And yet I think in a moment where, you know, we are facing some incredible crises, you know, just today I got the alert at 7:20 a.m. about the Code Maroon day here in Philadelphia, and decided, well, I guess my kids will be wearing masks once again to school. I mean, we are facing some incredible challenges currently, right, and in the years to come. And I think that, you know, one of what I see my role in academia, and in many ways I've always seen it, is to push the bigger, bolder ideas. I am not someone who has fashioned myself as the expert on this narrow area of the Fourth Amendment. And it's important that there are those scholars, but that's not the only type of law, exactly, professor. And I see myself as the person who is trying to really think the really bold, ambitious, maybe sometimes crazy ideas about how to reorder society. And I think that was something for me that really informed a minor revolution. Now, you know, how the books are connected. One of the interesting things in writing Unfair that came out at the very end was I was writing all of these kind of narrow prescriptions, right? So it would be like, hey, we have this problem with false confessions. And some of those problems like involve juveniles, right? Juveniles are particularly susceptible to maximization and minimization techniques that are used in the most commonly employed, you know, read method of interrogation. And so my fixes were, okay, we need to change our interview style to avoid this, or ban lying to juvenile suspects or whatever.
Can you just explain minimalist and maximalist?
Yeah, so it's roughly kind of the good cop, bad cop approach. And one of the things that we know about that is that particularly teen suspects who are brought in are often sort of feeling really acute distress. Sometimes they have a strong desire just to please authority figures. And often they think, well, if I just tell, I know I'm innocent, but if I just tell this officer what they want to hear, I can at least get out. And they'll continue to look for other evidence. And the problem is, as soon as you say you did it,
that is such a powerful.
That's
the evidence. Right.
You're going to be convicted, and the police stop looking for anyone else. This can be particularly problematic when officers, lie to juvenile suspects. They say, "Hey, your friend just gave you up. Like you're gonna, be."
Why are they allowed to do that? I just don't understand.
I think it's a fear of the bad man, and the idea that, you know, to combat evil, you have to be a little bit evil. You can't play fair with bad guys kids. Yeah. But I think the same thing is, I think that halo of innocence, once we're talking about a crime, disappears. And it's almost the opposite. It's almost like when a kid does something really bad, it's like worse than if a man, because this is truly a monster. Right?
Oh, because they must be depraved.
Exactly.
If they're such young,
if this
person
is possible. Yeah.
Early in crime, they must just be bad to the bone or something.
Yeah, and I think that is backed up by some of the relevant psych research. I think working on this project and thinking about these kind of important ways we could reform interrogation procedures or eyewitness identifications or change how we deal with imprisonment, I kept running up against, well, maybe this is all responding after the fact. And maybe what I should really be pushing forward on is kind of interventions which are aimed much earlier, indeed, that are about, right, how we protect invest in and empower children. It seemed to me that so many, not just criminal justice, but so many societal problems had their origins in our mistreatment of children. And I think that kind of tied into all these, this other research and work I'd done on kind of kids, things actually related to like the origins of the obesity epidemic and the way that fast food companies targeted kids or cigarette companies targeted kids. And I think that kind of idea of what if I wrote this rights book that wasn't from kind of a natural rights perspective, saying we need to protect children's rights because they morally deserve it, even though I believe that's true. What if I made the case that we need to protect children's rights? Indeed, we need to put children first, not simply because that's the right thing to do morally, but because that's the best path to the society we all want to live in. Because so many societal problems have their origins in childhood. And it's not a zero-sum game, right? It's, as a society, you always have to pay. And the question is just, when do you pay? Do you want to pay pennies on prevention? Do you want to pay pennies on those preschools and on, you know, maternal and early childhood health? And, or do you want to pay right after problems have metastasized and hardened in adulthood? You're going to pay many dollars if you wait. And so I think that's kind of the origins of this project. And, you know, what has really changed, I think, over time is becoming a father. I think I was someone who was always interested as a kid in children's rights issues. Even as a little kid, I was really aware of kind of the abuse or deprivations that kids faced. I personally was really lucky, but I think I saw a lot of terrible injustice towards kids, towards my friends, other kids I knew. And I think I have never thought it was right that you could hit a kid and you can't hit a prisoner, but you can hit a kid. I never thought it made sense that as a 12-year-old, I couldn't vote for president. And I think what's really neat, but also, you know, kind of just funny, like that I think people change and yet people also don't change. The same arguments that resonated with me that I came up with as a 12-year-old when I was talking to my parents about why can't I vote for, they still hit me today. And I think that's right. And so I think that was the long-winded, you know, how I came to write this new book.
Can I ask you something about, before we talk about the six different rights that you're proposing, I guess two things. First would be, you mentioned in the introduction that at some point you learned that your best friend's father had been spanking him. And I'm curious how you learned this and how old was this child?
So this would have been quite, you know, elementary school. And, you know, kind of the 5 to 8 kind of range. And it was, you know, it was something where, you know, over at the friend's house and, you know, the threat was made to the younger brother. I remember the younger brother getting pulled out and hearing that happening in the other room. And again, you know, I think... it was really hard because I felt so lucky. My dad.
So you told your parents when you went home that day, or
I don't remember how we talked about it. I was really open with my parents, but I also kept a lot of my fears and upset kind of hidden from my parents. I think I was thinking about. A lot of bad things. I think I was thinking about nuclear war and all these things when I was a little kid. And I think it's one of the things, though, that because I know what I thought about as a kid, when people are like, kids aren't affected, they're thinking about video games and they're not worried about climate change and they're not worried about guns, they're not scared about guns. I've always known that is a lie. And certainly in the conversations that I had with kids, they know what a lockdown feels like. That is not a, that doesn't matter to them. They know, and they have those fears, and they are thinking about those so-called adult subjects. And so when we don't empower them or don't talk to them about those things, we're not protecting them because they're already exposed to all this stuff. And I think, you know, one of the things, though, that was very, very frustrating to me, I remember, and I still feel this way, was just the idea that that was private business. That was, you know, what was happening within a family wasn't something that the kid had any rights about, and certainly nothing that I or my parents or anyone else ought to weigh in on. And that just always struck me as terribly hypocritical. You can't go up and strike someone on the street. You can't hit a, we've gotten rid of corporal punishment for kids. And what's really shocking, you know, I mentioned this young man, Wiley, who I talk about in chapter five, and it was an incredible story, right? This is shortly after the Parkland shooting. He decides, he's living in a conservative little town in Arkansas. He decides, you know, I really care about gun violence. And there's this walkout that's going to be organized across the country. And I'm going to take part in 17 minutes of silence, 1 minute for each victim. You're supposed to go out to the flagpole. So at whatever it is, 10 a.m. that morning, he gets up. He's the only kid who stands up in this little, you know, very Republican community, high school, public school. And he goes out and, you know, there's one or two other kids out there when he gets out. And, you know, the principal, the dean of students comes out and is like, well, you boys better get back in here. There's going to be consequences. You guys better. And they say, no, this actually matters. I'm going to engage in this silent protest for 17 minutes. They go back in. And there are consequences. And the choice that is provided to Wiley is you can either be suspended for protesting gun violence or, and this is a public school, you can be given swats. What does that mean? That means being hit with a wooden cricket bat that has the words Board of Education on.
Hit where? Hit in the head or hit in the butt?
Hit in the butt. Hitting in the back of the thighs.
That's so messed up.
Essentially the principal in a public school. And that is completely legal in the United States today that you can hit a kid with a bat for protesting violence. And so again, I had outrage about things like that when I was a kid, and I still have outrage about them today.
I see it in your face. You're almost crying about it, and yeah. this kind of abuse of power, it resonates in your book because it stems from this idea of children as property, as opposed to if you can be deeply attached to your children. However you want to define who your children is. And I like the way that you have done that in the book. But you could deeply attach to your children and have what you call authoritative as opposed to authoritarian approach to parenting. And you can want the best for them, but not without, but you don't have to treat them as your property or as a reflection on you. Like you're meeting this person who has arrived in your world, as how I view parenting. Mm-hmm. And how do you help them flourish and meet them where they are and watch them develop and help them with whatever comes their way to become a functioning, independent adult. Like I said to my kid, one of my kids the other day, you know, you remember that your goal is to find your gifts, explore them, express yourself, and to find your friends. And if you're doing something hard, don't just push yourself to do something hard for the sake of impressing someone else. You should be doing hard things and pushing yourself toward your own dreams or to helping others. I don't know. It's just so interesting how the world conditions you, at least the worlds you and I may be occupied. It's just the around us to succeed. But, you know, are we going to be good sheep or are we going to be ourselves and contribute to the betterment of those around us.
Yeah.
And I want the latter.
And I think, you know, part of the problem is that over the course of the 20th century, you know, I think we gave up on this idea that children were like our future, and it was therefore our collective responsibility to protect and invest kids. So one of the remarkable things, if you look at the history, is at the turn of the century, there were all of these progressives coming out and saying, hey, right, this is the future of our nation, these kids. And so if they're working in factories and getting black lungs in the coal mines, like, this is going to have horrible repercussions. Rather than being in school, this is going to have horrible repercussions for our
future. Right?
Yeah. Same thing with, you know, if they're being poisoned as infants by, you know, consuming morphine or alcohol, if they are, you know, if schools are crumbling, right? Everything ought to be focused on preparing the next generation. This is a communal enterprise. I think over the course of the 20th century, that vision really gave way for a vision which put everything into parents. Parents were the ultimate deciders. Parents were the ones who were going to determine the custody, control, education of their kids. And part of that was broad societal forces, but part of that came from elite institutions like the Supreme Court.
And racism, right? I mean, we haven't talked about that. I know it's interspersed in everything you write about, but I think about someone who praised your book, a friend of the show, Heather McGee, who wrote The Sum of Us. And I do think a lot of this is that drain pool politics that she talks about.
Huge.
Where, you know where I'm headed with this, where that, you know, if we have an us-them mentality to the extent that, you know, there is a good portion of white society who wants to maintain a caste system based on a racial hierarchy, it's a lot easier to create these sort of private enclaves and then basically not provide, resources or attention to public systems and public goods.
I was just going to say, one of the things that's really interesting about this shift to parents' rights is that it also then becomes a framework where you can blame bad parents and pat on the back good parents. And that means, instead, poverty, for example, is not something we need to address as a society. You know, 1 in 7 children today in a country with, you know, 720 billionaires, there are like 11 million kids living in poverty. Well, why is that even possible? Part of that is this idea that it's up to parents, and therefore, like, we can't reward bad parents by providing free school lunches. We can't, you know, that would be to turn our back on personal responsibility. And so I think, you know, in many ways, what's problematic, even for affluent white parents like me, about this narrative is it becomes exhausting and terrible to be a parent, because now everything rests on your own decision. You have to be, right, the person who's deciding on your own individual vaccine schedule. You have to be the one, like, how safe is my school? Let me check if there's water in, you know, that there's lead in the water at school, and let me pack my kid's lunch. And it becomes too much for all of us, as opposed to actually relying on our incredible wealth and our incredible resources as a society. You don't have to do it all alone if you believe in raising kids being this group endeavor.
I sure do believe that. This book is amazing, and I want folks to read it so they can actually see the rights. But can you walk through kind of the six of them? And one thing I didn't notice or would like you to emphasize is things like when you say the first years, roughly what years you mean, or you cabin off something as early childhood versus late. Mm-hmm. And I don't really, because my kids are now in their teens and 20s, I forgot what those terms mean. So do you want to walk through those before we wrap up?
Yeah, sure. So I kind of focus on these six rights, which I describe as kind of core rights, as a means to kind of get into what I call kind of a child first mindset. So if the goal here is that prioritizing kids is the best way to create that society that we all want, here's a pathway to do that. And it's kind of recognizing these core rights attached to particular stages of development. Are these the only important rights that children deserve? Absolutely not. But I think these are six incredibly important ones. The first one I focus on, which really is kind of, you know, the first years, I would say 0 to 3, is focused on the right to attachment. So we have a wealth of psychological and other research that suggests that attachment with a primary caregiver is essential for setting children on, you know, successful paths through older childhood into adulthood. And yet, in countless ways, we sever valuable bonds or fail to support bonds, particularly between children and their parents. One of the ways we do that is by not being the only kind of wealthy, advanced nation not to have free paid mandatory care leave for the parents of young children. But we also do this with the criminal justice system, where we callously remove hundreds of thousands of children from the people they were living with before their guardians committed crimes. We obviously do this with the child separation policy at the border. Mm-hmm. And we do this with the foster care system, particularly through the child welfare system. We deal with poverty not by giving poor parents the things that they need to care for their children, but by taking them, removing those children from their parents. The second chapter is focused on the right to investment. This is really looking at early childhood, sort of ages 4 to 7. Here, I claim that, you know, the radical, very disparate trajectories of poor children and the children of wealthy Americans is very bad for our country, and that we ought to recognize a right of all children to societal wealth. And I argue that we need to address the way we pass wealth between generations, shifting from a model of inheritance based on this idea of preserving dynastic wealth to one that's based on this idea of collective investment. And we really need to shift our budgets from, again, as I pointed out earlier, it's not a zero-sum game, shift our money so we're spending that money also earlier in the lifespan, because we just get a lot more bang for the buck that way rather than waiting for the problems to arise in adulthood. Now, the third chapter is the right to community. Here, we've already kind of touched on, this is kind of ages 8 to 11. Here, what I'm really talking about is kind of the way that we in the United States have empowered parents as the deciders, and that we need to shift from thinking about children as belonging to their parents to this idea of every child having a right to a sense of belonging, of being connected to the broader community and benefiting from those personal relationships, knowledge, services that come from that inclusion. And here, you know, I tell stories of just the crazy way we are denying kids a right to learn about their history and who they are. This is really, I think, one of the most relevant, and likely to be one of the most relevant as we move to the 2024 election. It looks like Ron DeSantis is squarely positioning himself as the, you know, parents' rights candidate. And I think that, you know, that's going to be a major focus as we move into the next 2 years. Then the next chapter is the right to be a kid. Here I'm really looking at ages 12 to 15. And what I'm interested here in arguing in favor for is the notion that kids have a right to be judged based on their unique capacities as children, to be safeguarded based on their unique vulnerabilities. Oftentimes, we get it wrong, right? We treat children as adults, particularly in the criminal justice system, when they deserve our compassion and understanding. But we also get it wrong the other way, failing to protect kids from really significant dangers, often, you know, adultifying them at the same time that we fail to regulate things like social media or other things that corporations are involved in. The fifth chapter is about the right to be heard. Here, I'm really arguing for a right to vote for young people, a right to serve on juries.
At what age? Like age 16, the right to vote?
Well, I think that's the most likely path forward in the United States. Now, there are a number of countries, countries as diverse as, you know, Austria and Brazil, who have already lowered their voting age. There are certain local jurisdictions in the United States that have done that. I think that's the most likely practical pathway. But ultimately, I think we kind of look at this the wrong way. Oftentimes, even the people who are advocating for this right now are very focused on establishing the age at which the average, say, the average 16-year-old appears like the average adult in the voting booth. But of course, many below average adults vote all of the time. And we have generally rejected any sorts of tests or capacity arguments in for very good reasons over the course of history. And so I think a better question is to ask, what are the conditions in which we will remove the vote from someone? And if you look there, it's almost always an individual determination. It's not a general incapacity, like someone might not be able to dress themselves or get themselves to, or even read. And we make accommodations for individuals who need extra help. And I think that, to me, is where, as a society, we would ideally go, is actually thinking about maybe allowing everyone to vote, maybe even allowing parents or guardians to exercise that proxy vote until someone was actually ready to themselves assert their right to vote individually. But I think that would actually result in better policy. I think a family of four with two kids, local mayor election a couple weeks ago, I think my family should have four votes, not two votes, because there are four Philadelphians in my household.
Right.
So the final check.
And when you think about this for local, I mean, when you think about the biggest budget in my town is the school budget.
Sure. And you think about the fact, you know, that there is no counting. We talk about one person, one vote. That's the goal. Well, why is you think a 17-year-old isn't a person? 15-year-old isn't a person. I think one of the biggest things that I have already touched on, though, is people who think, okay, I'm convinced that maybe this is not the decision between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Maybe that's not actually the most complex choice that a person has. Personally, I think that my 9-year-old is making a harder choice when they're picking out their breakfast cereal in the morning. But maybe that doesn't convince you. I think the argument that kids, a 9-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 15-year-old, is going to live with the consequences of the 2024 election. They are going to live through the wildfires and the social unrest and all of those consequences a lot more than someone who is 85 years old. I think that's a particularly compelling reason to extend the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the sixth and final chapter is focused on the cusp of adulthood. And really here, I'm thinking of 18 to 25. And what I think is really tragic is the way that in many ways we promise people, if you make it to the end, you are free. We'll finally let you off the leash. And yet, in many ways, we tether people down. We burden them with our choices. The wars we fought will be paid for by those people who are becoming adults today. We burden them with our rules related to zoning. We burden them with sort of rules about entering the job market. And I think here we really have to look to ways to truly allow young people to start their adult lives free.
Right. Free of student loan debt, I would imagine you would throw into that. So, I guess in our final minutes, I'm going to let folks read the book to know everything you're prescribing to accomplish this. We already heard you just say one thing is, you know, allowing everyone to vote. Most realistically, it would be implemented first for 16-year-olds. Is there any other, you call this a minor revolution, which is a great title and play on words. Other revolutionary ideas in this book you want to share?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the big takeaway of the book is that a lot of the really significant harms that we impose on young people, I think, are the result of not being aware of how young people are impacted by what we do. And so I think one of the biggest solutions, I think, is to create mechanisms to draw our attention towards children, not away from them. One of the ways I suggest we can do that is adopting child impact assessment as a core part of government. Certain countries in Europe are already doing this as a standard process when it comes to lawmaking and regulations. I think another way that I think we could make progress is actually creating a standalone federal agency. We actually had such an agency back. You mentioned Taft at the beginning of the broadcast, and I think, you know, in 1912, he signed into law this first federal agency focused on the whole child. I think we have to get back to that notion that we need that level of attention to children's issues and to prioritizing kids. I think we actually need to rethink what businesses do. I think shareholder primacy has been a tragedy. And indeed, I think the biggest threat going forward to kids probably is from companies. They are the most powerful and will continue to be the most powerful entities in society. And so I actually argue in favor of adopting child primacy, not simply as a way to avoid harms to kids, but to actually think about the long-term profitability of companies and to make things, I think, a little bit more tangible in a way that I think certain sustainability initiatives and different things that we've seen have tended to be a lot more about show and a lot less about substance.
So I'm going to ask you probably the most challenging question right at the end, and I apologize. But one thing, as I'm reading the book, and also in particular, as you just raised the role of business here and earlier in offering products or services that impact children, sometimes not in the greatest way, and I think you know where I'm headed here, is that so much of this comes down to who decides. In other words, I'm not happy with the people taking their guns out in their backyard and shooting at the Target logo because Target is offering LGBTQ plus merchandise for Pride Month. Now, there are some parents out there, I might believe they're wrong, who think that this is an example of corporations doing bad things for kids, whereas you might be thinking, no, it's the kind of stuff that we heard the former marketing or executive from Facebook talk about in terms of serving up to kids with the algorithm harmful content about, let's say, dieting and creating eating disorders. So there can be, like, you could have, and then some parents might say, no, that's perfectly fine. I want my kid to be healthy. So everything sounds good to me about putting children first, but there isn't a public consensus about what that means. Sorry, Adam.
I don't think you need to apologize at all. I think that's an excellent, excellent question. And I think that the answer to me is that I fully acknowledge that is a challenge. I think that there have been throughout history and currently people who claim to be acting on behalf of children, while in my opinion, deeply undermining their interests. So what can we do about that? Well, I think the first response is, we are in a much better position to look out for children's interests if we actually are formally talking about children, right? I think the more they are ignored and we're talking about parents' interests or other people's interests, the less likely we are going to be able to actually protect, empower, and invest in kids. And so I think simply requiring us to actually talk about children and confront evidence and collect evidence on children is absolutely a step forward. Now, I think the other part of the solution here is that we actually need to bring children's voices into every one of these conversations. And so I think it's when we have a bunch of adults saying children deserve X and a bunch of adults saying children deserve Y, it's going to be a battle. I think, how do we break the tiebreaker? Well, let's bring in actual children's voices on these core issues. They have opinions on guns. They have opinions on bans on books. But right now, how are they used? Well, it's a photo backdrop behind DeSantis when he signs the latest bill. And unfortunately, right. I think the response of a lot of progressives has been, well, we need a robust liberal parents' rights movement. And I want to say, I love parents. I believe that parents have right. rights. Don't get me wrong. I do think that. It's that I want to have a conversation about children's rights. I want to hear from children, and I want the children to have a formal say on what is happening in those schools, not adults, and particularly not legislators, particularly far removed from those issues.
My penultimate question is, this conversation reminds me of a book I read in elementary school by Louise Fitzhugh, who wrote the Harriet the Spy books. She wrote a book called Nobody's Family is Going to Change. Hmm. Have you ever read this
children's
book? I
haven't read it,
book?
But I will put it on my list.
Oh, it's brilliant. It's about the children's rights movement in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
And it with the lead character is a, I think, maybe a boy, a preteen age boy. I forgot what part of the country they're living in. And I know that he really wanted to tap dance, but his father didn't want him to do, because that would be what gay kids do. And his father wouldn't want that. And then somehow he and then someone else got involved in this underground children's rights movement. It's
sounds
a book
fascinating.
That it's really good. It's fabulous book. I haven't read it since the 70s, but I recommend that. Okay. And my very last question is, what did I leave out? What didn't I ask you today that you want to say?
Well, I think, you know, the last thing here is you know, I think some people worry as we start to talk about children's rights, that we're going to be taking away from other people's rights. I think that's the normal response when I get critical feedback from folks, is as soon as we start talking about children's rights, it's suddenly like, well, this is going to infringe on other people's rights. And I think, you know, I mentioned it before, but I don't see that at all in what I've written, and certainly the research I do. I think that one of the wonderful things about focusing on children is about, you know, where we focus our attention for the benefit of all of us and for the benefit of all stages of one's life. And so I think, you know, if the question is, you know, are you anti-parent, which I sometimes get, I think my response is absolutely not. I want to make things easier for parents. I want a world in which I don't have to worry about my kids at school. I don't have to worry about the air quality. I don't have to worry about when I'm not here to take care of them. And so I think being child first is actually a way to support parents, not a way to take away from their rights.
Excellent point. And thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
That was a fascinating conversation. I really wanted to hear even more about Adam's writing process and his own childhood, which seems to have been a very happy one, and what made him so attuned to the suffering of others. But I'm sure I'll have another chance to talk to him in person at some point in the near future. And I'll be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com. You can also write to us at Booked Up, P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find us.